I'm Sam Freeman, and this is Practicing. Of all the problems we face in clinical medicine, few are more vexing than patient interactions that don't go well. Dealing with a difficult patient, as they're commonly referred to, can ruin your day and set off a spiraling cascade of thoughts and emotions. Those patient encounters frustrate us and drain us as clinicians. They can leave us feeling at once helpless and self-righteous, empathetic and disdainful. Often, they make us want to run away. Other times, they suck us in to an uncomfortable degree. I'd say doctors spend as much, if not more, time talking to each other about difficult patients as they do about difficult diagnoses. Hearing my next guest, Dr. Autumn Feaster, lecture on the difficult patient was one of those rare moments when a phenomenon I thought I had a handle on based on my own experience was completely reframed. Her ideas led me to see the problem from an entirely different angle, and to reinterpret my past experiences as a result. Autumn Feaster is a philosopher and bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's vice chair for education in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine, as well as the faculty program director for the Master of Bioethics and Master of Science in Medical Ethics degrees. She's the director of the Penn Program in Clinical Conflict Management, which promotes conflict resolution training for clinical providers and clinical ethics consultants. She's the author of over 100 publications in the areas of clinical ethics, clinical conflict management, and more. I think my conversation with Autumn will really appeal to clinicians who've necessarily had the experience of navigating conflictual or dysfunctional patient relationships. But I also think what Autumn has to say is enlightening for anyone who's been a patient. As she says, we have all been, or have the potential to be, difficult patients. Now, before we get to our conversation, I have a brief announcement. This is the 20th episode of Practicing, a milestone I'm not sure I ever thought I'd reach when I started the podcast 2 years ago. It seems like a good moment for me to take a break, regroup, and dedicate some time to other projects. Now, this isn't a farewell, it's just to see you later. I may return with the occasional interview over the coming months, but my hope is to come back with fresh ideas. So please stay subscribed. Thanks to all of you for your precious attention, and to those of you who sent feedback, subscribed, shared or rated the show, or helped and supported me in countless other ways. I really couldn't have done it without you. And of course, thanks to all my guests. You are what Practicing is all about. And now, here's my conversation with Autumn Feaster. Autumn Feaster, welcome to Practicing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your work. You have a PhD in philosophy. Your master's degree before that was in sociology. How did you come to work in the world of clinical ethics?
When I did my PhD in philosophy, I was always concerned about the field that I had chosen being too armchair, if you will, too removed from any kind of concrete impact that my work might be able to have out in the world beyond just the way that philosophy serves a great purpose in helping people think more critically or answering the big questions. But philosophers typically talk to philosophers. And I didn't want that for my career, which is why I didn't start in philosophy. You know, I started in sociology. So when I was finishing my dissertation, I was introduced to the field of bioethics. And it was really my husband who pointed out that this could really be the way in which philosophy could have a concrete impact on real phenomena. I encountered the book by Nancy Dubler and Carol Liebman called Bioethics Mediation, and it was very influential for me. Thinking about how clinical ethics consultants are often asked to give advice. They call it recommendations about other people's lives, about loved ones that are not their loved ones, bodies that are not theirs, made me very uncomfortable. And being introduced by this book to a different way of assisting people in ethical crisis in clinical settings made so much sense to me.
Had you had any experience yourself with difficult clinical situations as a patient or as a caregiver or family member or friend?
I think we all have. I don't think you meet anyone in the United States who cannot list some challenge, frustration, error, things that have gone wrong in the clinic, either for themselves or people in their inner circle or their loved ones. I don't know that you meet anyone who hasn't had some type of experience clinically that didn't go well. It is such a common phenomenon that, yes, I did, but so did lots of people that I knew and stories that I'd heard from others.
This really ties into the way I came to learn about your work, which was when I heard you speak about the difficult patient. So that's a phrase that will, I think, immediately be quite evocative to anyone who's been engaged in clinical work, who's a practitioner in healthcare and in any related field. But tell us a little, very simply, what is a difficult patient in that context?
That's a great question, because what a difficult patient is whatever a healthcare provider finds challenging to work with at any particular time and for any particular reason. In other words, the difficult patient is in the eye of the beholder, and the beholder is the nurse or the physician. And there really are no parameters around it. A patient doesn't have to reach, for example, a very particular threshold of challengingness or difficulty before landing in the category and being sorted into the category of difficult patient. If a nurse or a physician is finding it difficult to deal with, interact, treat a patient or a family, that's the definition. That person has become categorized as difficult.
So it's a label, essentially, and you're saying it's an arbitrary one and almost a circular one, because what makes you difficult is that someone finds you difficult. There isn't an objective set of criteria.
And I believe that nurses and physicians would say that it encompasses behavior that ranges from non-compliant or surly or rude or unfriendly, all the way to verbal abuse or name calling or comments that are insulting, all the way to someone who's being physically threatening. I think it's not arbitrary. It's on a continuum, but the continuum is very broad, and it's so broad that except for the most congenial and even-keeled among us, there's not many patients or families who couldn't land themselves in the category of difficult patient or difficult family. I would imagine that if you ask nurses and physicians for the percentage of patients that they deem difficult, they would say, I don't know, 10, 40%. But I think that there are very few people who couldn't, in some circumstance, end up being in that category. So if pushed enough or the circumstances were ripe for it, I think there aren't many of us who wouldn't be difficult in certain circumstances, even though I think that I wouldn't imagine that nurses and physicians would agree with that statement.
I actually have an anecdote in mind involving me where I had felt myself becoming that a little bit when my daughter was born, and I wasn't happy to be in the hospital anymore, and I kind of made my dissatisfaction heard. And I remember having the thought at the time, they must be talking about me the way I've spoken about patients who ask for something, go against the flow of what the team wants. So I had actually highlighted that sentence in one of your papers where you write, most of us can become difficult given the right conditions.
That is exactly the problem. And I appreciate your anecdote because not only do I think there are few Americans who have not encountered challenging circumstances or clinical moments, I think many of us believe that there have been nurses and physicians who have thought of us as difficult. And there have been many circumstances in which the clinical encounter has not been good, has not been positive, the experience has not been satisfying. And I think that that is a near universal experience in American healthcare. And I think that if physicians and nurses better understood the causal mechanism for why the patients and families are comporting themselves the way that they are, I think it would lend itself to much more effective solutions and interventions. The common way that physicians and nurses conceive of a patient or a family who's difficult is that there is something constitutionally wrong with that individual. There's some defect, there's some flaw that could be a character flaw, or they could have some type of mental illness. I'm convinced that thinking about the problem being located in a person as a category is completely wrong-headed. It's people become difficult in certain kinds of circumstances, and people are easy to work with in other kinds of circumstances. And if that's true, then we need to think about the circumstances in which one has patients and families that are congenial and pleasant and friendly and cooperative, and those circumstances where that falls apart.
It's interesting, Autumn, to hear you talk about this idea that the status of difficult patient is sort of contingent and based on circumstance rather than core to who the individual is. So I buy that completely. And yet, as a clinician myself, I'm married to a physician. Obviously, many of my friends are physicians. When they talk about a difficult interaction, a difficult type of patient, there is a certain common pattern, a certain flavor to the interaction. And I wonder if that resonates with you, if that has come up in your work, and what you think that's about.
Tell me about the flavor or the pattern.
I guess the stereotype is people who already seem to be dissatisfied with what you're going to provide as a set of options, set of solutions. They will have often many symptoms, many complaints that seem disconnected, a pattern of illness that is inconsistent with our training and knowledge, I guess. They will have a story maybe of already being disappointed by other clinical encounters. They'll share that with you, and then they will be maybe demanding or express their dissatisfaction with what you're trying to offer. You know, there's this expression of the heart sink patient, a patient where just in seeing what they're coming for or just in their energy, you'll feel kind of drained as a clinician. You'll feel you cannot satisfy them. And it can give this feeling that you sort of want to get rid of them. That sounds harsh, but I think it's true.
I think your description is completely in line with what the literature says about the difficult patient, that is a literature written by physicians. So I think you've captured it perfectly. And I want to give a satisfying answer, but to do that, I have to give an unsatisfying answer first. And it's this: when we encounter someone who is not in a good place, who has already had accumulated frustrations, disappointments, we don't encounter them with a clean slate. And it means that when someone comes to your office who has already had a collection of negative experiences or encounters or disappointments and frustrations, they have already exhausted their resilience, their clean slateness, their ability to just roll with it. The reason I want to say that this is unsatisfying is because healthcare and the experience of healthcare is, for most people, inherently frustrating. The individual doctor, the individual nurse can be very, very lovely, but the system that surrounds that care is unbelievably frustrating. The healthcare industry for patients, it's like the airline industry, it's just inherently frustrating. But it's also the case that medicine has serious limitations that are not always acknowledged to patients. So when someone comes to you, and you've put it very nicely, very articulately, comes to you with a cluster of symptoms that don't fit a template, medicine just doesn't have the capability to diagnose every condition that a patient comes with. But patients have the expectation that you do, and medicine itself talks about itself as if it does. So when you put those two things together, I walk into your office and I already have a history, and that history isn't positive. Let's look at each of those two prongs. Let's talk about how medicine is frustrating. It's frustrating at making an appointment. It's frustrating at scheduling. It's frustrating at financing. It's frustrating at wait times. And that's before I even meet you. And it isn't just about bureaucratic frustrations. The people I meet along the way may not be kind. They may not be empathic. So I may not feel that I was treated very well by the system, by the coordinator, by the receptionist, by the intake nurse, all collectively adding up to where my head is by the time I meet you. The second wing of this is, if I've come to you with symptoms that haven't been addressed by others before you, then I'm already in near despair that anyone will solve this. My symptoms feel very real to me. I don't know that you can help me. I probably mistrust you or think that you can't help me. Put those two things together. And I ask, how would one expect that individual to comport themselves?
Right. And I would add to that, that the other element is that, yes, it's hard to be sick. Healthcare is hard on the patient and it's intrinsically limited, but also healthcare is hard on the provider. So the experience of providing care is not always one in which a person is at their best.
That's right. And thank you for adding that. It's so important. The physician is exhausted and the physician's overworked. The physician has been through incredible traumas, especially now with the pandemic. Seeing people sick day after day and having to meet people's needs and try to figure out how you meet your own, the physician is not at their best either. When you put all that together, I don't find it any wonder. And yet there does seem to be an expectation that patients and families will be at their best. I don't see how that could possibly be the case. Then you add on to that the fatigue and the feeling of helplessness or burnout from the provider side. And I am surprised that as many encounters go well as go well.
It's true.
Let's talk about the healthcare system frustrations. When a patient or family has already experienced those frustrations and have tried to find answers or resolutions, it's no one's fault and there's no one who's accountable. And so when you actually get face to face with a nurse or a physician, that may be the first time you've actually been interacting with a human being to whom you can press for accountability. For example, you ask if I have had these experiences. I have them all the time. I made an appointment for a loved one. The appointment used to be housed locally. So if you called an office, you were actually trying to make an appointment at that office. Now appointments are often centralized. So the appointment was made for the wrong location, even though I was very clear. So the appointment that was supposed to happen, let's say at 11 o'clock, was an hour away from where my loved one showed up for the appointment. But who are you going to ask for the accountability for that? Someone made a mistake, but that someone was probably in some call center. But the repercussions for that patient or that family are quite large. Then they get in front of the nurse or the physician and they're not in a good place. But you know what? It wasn't your fault. As the physician, it wasn't your fault. No, but But where do we go for the accountability, for the frustrations that have built by the time we get there? You don't have the answer to that, I know. But what it does lead me to think is that if we're really going to solve the problem of the difficult patient and physician, we need to spend a lot more attention on these systemic frustrations and try to think about how would we make healthcare great? How would we make it Costco? You know, everybody goes to Costco and has such a positive experience. How do we make healthcare Costco instead of the airline industry? Because you're paying the price. Physicians and nurses are paying the price and being on the brunt of how ground down and worn down patients and families are by the time you even meet them.
I wonder if there's any data or any sense of who the patients are who are labeled as difficult. Do they have any common demographic or other characteristics?
I believe that physicians would anticipate that they do, and I believe that they don't. There is data from the perspective of physicians who lands themselves in the category of difficult. So there are surveys of physicians that ask, what kind of patients do you find difficult? And that's a certain kind of data. What there isn't is, here's someone I found difficult. Let's ask this difficult patient why they were difficult. And that's the data that I think would be much more informative. I also think that if you're asking physicians' perspective about who is difficult, bias that is class or race-based or, you know, other kinds of demographics, I think will play into that data, but I don't think it will give you a very telling picture. It will say more about bias than it will say about what it takes to provoke someone into being difficult. That said, wouldn't we expect that individuals who have vastly more resources to manage second opinions or incorrect appointments or distance travel would be able to manage those frustrations better than individuals who are lower resourced? But does that mean then that lower resourced people are more likely to be difficult? My guess is no.
Right. That's my intuition as well, is that people from marginalized groups who are more easily othered in general might more easily be labeled as difficult. But I want to be clear about the labeling. It's not that they are, it's that they might be perceived that way. Also, there's a very well-known pattern, to me anyway, that women more often get put in this role, in this category, than men. There are entire diseases where people were just labeled as difficult or as, you know, inconsolable, perseverating about their symptoms, something like endometriosis, which ends up to be something very real.
Probably it will turn out that all of these physical ailments are real. They just may be surfacing at a time before medicine has a good template to explain them. I think about this, a physician who was telling me that they worked very hard to try to get to the bottom of this woman's symptoms. They threw the book at it. They used every test and all kinds of, you know, examinations to try to get to the bottom of it. And she was very cooperative through this entire diagnostic path. At the end of the day, they couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. And so what they said was that it was psychosomatic. Her interactions became quite negative and they labeled her as difficult. I can't imagine anyone who has suffered physical symptoms and been through a long diagnostic journey only to be told it's in your head. I don't know who would not be difficult. It would be much better for physicians to say idiopathic, we just don't know, rather than to say psychosomatic. She took offense at that, but wouldn't you? I certainly would.
Absolutely. What do we know about the impact on clinicians of these interactions call them difficult interactions. How does it affect practitioners?
There is literature about how working with challenging patients impacts physicians and nurses, and it's very negative. And I'm glad you're raising that, because this problem is so, it's so hard, but I don't want to neglect at all what that impact is on the physician. The data shows that the impact can range from depression and anxiety to burnout and a desire to leave the profession. The impact is very severe, and the data, I think, is very compelling. And it's because of the impact, not just on patients and families, but on providers, that we really need to find a way to enable providers to deal more effectively with patients and families they find challenging for their own well-being, not just for the moral obligation that they have to patients and families. To understand how to manage effectively patients you find challenging is to protect your own sanity and well-being and your own job satisfaction. But physicians go about it the wrong way. They try to solve this problem with ineffective strategies. And if they had effective strategies, they would be serving their own interests, not just the interests of patients and families. Part of why I talk so much about the dynamics that bring a patient or a family member to become difficult is so that we can think more constructively about how we reverse those dynamics, how we repair those relationships, how we make healthcare satisfying for the provider and not just for the patients and families. I can't emphasize that enough. But when a physician categorizes a patient as being in the category of difficult, they have already sabotaged the potential to alter that dynamic, because they have made the problem, they've defined the problem as being located in the person and not in the dynamic. If physicians could come to understand that interactions that are negative are about interactions, and interactions can be altered, they can be improved with the right kind of technique, then the response from physicians would actually contribute to the solution of that dynamic and not simply exacerbating that dynamic.
Tell me a little about the typical ways that clinicians will try to deal with these difficult interactions.
It is, I think, typical for physicians to try to deliver the standard of care, treat the patient to the best of their abilities, and try to remove themselves from that clinical encounter as quickly as possible. In other words, I think the physicians operate with the highest level of clinical integrity, so they try to offer the patient good clinical service, but I think their goal is to deal with difficult patients by trying to detach themselves and remove themselves as quickly as possible, to remove themselves from the negative stimuli. We know that physicians will try to avoid certain patients.
That definitely resonated. There was a second type, though, of response that I also found interesting, which is a kind of opposite to that, an over-sympathizing, a total dissolving of any boundary between the patient's need and the clinician. Can you tell me a little about that, too?
I think that physicians trying to manage challenging patients often talk about boundaries. And I think that they use that term in a way that is well-intended, especially to protect their own well-being, which is an important goal. But I think that physicians sometimes say, I need to impose a boundary. And it sounds like a psychologically savvy strategy, but it is often, in effect, a kind of barrier to making the kind of connection that is important to help patients who are struggling in the clinic. There are two types of empathy that clinicians could employ in the clinic. One type of empathy is an emotional kind of empathy in which the provider is feeling a great number of emotions with that patient. I'm not suggesting physicians not do that, but I am suggesting that it could have a cost to the physician, that that kind of emotional involvement can create those feelings of being overwhelmed or feelings of compassion fatigue or burnout. And so what I'm suggesting is that what physicians need to use with challenging patients is a kind of cognitive empathy where the physician is trying to explore conceptually the whys behind the patient's behavior. So what I'm advocating is an exploration of what is happening with you that you're reacting this way, or how can you help me understand what you're thinking or feeling without the physician themselves feeling that feeling. In other words, if you had a patient in front of you who was being rude or insulting, you could say to yourself, I'm going to put up boundaries here. And if what you mean is, I'm not going to let myself get sucked in emotionally to this dynamic, that's fine. But if what you mean is, I'm going to create the kind of distance so that now I'm offering perfunctory care, that boundary will actually sabotage your ability to create a really positive dynamic with that patient. So instead, what one ought to be doing is, yes, protecting your emotional well-being by using cognitive empathy to try to understand the patient's story. Why does the patient think that things are not going well? What are the needs of that patient? How does the patient understand this circumstance? And none of that should fatigue the physician, because that's a cognitive exercise, not an emotional or affective exercise.
Right. I mean, as I understand it, a boundary doesn't mean I'm not engaged. Actually, a boundary might allow you to be much more engaged and more open. It's more about distinguishing the fact that other people have their emotions, that they are not yours.
That's right.
And just because someone is mad, it's not necessarily about you. And you then can open a space to hold that anger and do something with it.
Even if their anger is at you, you can still have that boundary where you don't get emotionally involved with it. When patients are angry or frustrated, they need help. They need assistance. They need resolution or amelioration. And you're the one that is either being asked to give that help, or you have to be the one who thinks about the right person to get the patient or family that help. You're the gatekeeper if you're not the solver.
So you've referred to some conflict management techniques and skills, which I want to get to, because I think obviously that's an important part of your contribution and what you're bringing to changing the way providers deal with these kinds of circumstances. You've also written about the importance of relationship as a solution, or the start of a solution or an approach to these interactions. How does that work? How can clinicians use relationship and foster relationship to get to a better place in these interactions?
Once a physician has a great relationship with the patient, the work of conflict management, the structure has already been established. So I want to tweak your question a little bit. It's how does the physician build that kind of relationship where they can manage these kind of dynamics, not how do they use an established relationship to work with those dynamics? When you've got an established relationship, you're already 90% there. In the world of clinical ethics, there are initiatives to create patients' rights and responsibilities, which emphasize much more their responsibilities than their rights, I will say, but they often have language in them like, we care about you. And if I am in an interaction with a nurse or physician, and I believe the physician cares, we're already in a place where we can start to work through the challenges between us. The problem is when you're experiencing someone as difficult or as challenging, I'm not sure that the patient would say, this physician cares, this nurse cares. I'm not sure that they believe that. By the time I believe you care, we're already a good portion towards the solution. So the quest here is to build a relationship such that the family or the patient believes you do care, that you have that kind of investment. And how do you do that? You solicit their stories. You try to understand the worldview they have. What's the perspective they're bringing? How do they understand the problem? How do they feel about the problem? By the time you have engaged in those kind of inquiries with a patient or family, you have demonstrated through your activity that you care. You haven't just used words, I care. You've shown that you care by your investment. So if all of that seems muddled, the bottom line is invest. When you have a patient who is being challenging or difficult, invest in them. Ask the question, what's happening here? What can I do? Have I misunderstood the problem? What kind of resources can I bring to bear on this problem? What does it feel like for you to be experiencing this problem? Invest in that person. The higher the investment in a challenging patient or family, the lower the likelihood that that relationship will become difficult.
When I hear that, it makes a lot of sense. And I also, the clinician in me automatically says, that sounds good, but it sounds like it would take a lot of time.
I love that response because what we all know about American healthcare is that physicians don't have much time. Part of the frustration of American healthcare is that physicians don't have much time. The pressures that have been put on them for the volume they are asked to manage means that per person, you don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, it's same here in Canada.
Of course, that's a ubiquitous problem, but relationships can be developed very quickly by the right questions and the right body language. Relationships can be established quite quickly. To ask the question in a way that really solicits an honest response from patients or families doesn't really take that much time. You're right. The response a physician is going to give to what I've just said is, I would like to have an hour per person, but I don't. I submit you could get your care and concern conveyed in 5-10 minutes. With the right kind of questions. For example, somebody says to you, I've been waiting 6 months for an appointment. You say, I've had circumstances where I've had to wait 6 months. It's terrible. I'm so sorry that has happened to you. And maybe you can even suggest that you could look into what is the wait? What are the systemic solutions you could bring to bear? But by connecting to that and focusing on the frustrations that they're bringing, even if you can't solve it, you've made that investment. You've started to build that relationship and you haven't invested that much time. For example, you could say, I wish I had the power to do something about it. Because I can imagine how frustrating that was. That's only like a 10-second phrase.
Right. One thing I've noticed in my own practice, you know, I'm a pediatrician, and one thing that has really changed in my toolkit is that for 3 years now, I've had a child, so I have a 3-year-old, and just being able to very quickly echo the experience of families, their difficulties with their own child, with an experience that I've had, is very effective. And I find often allows for connection and is a tool that, because of circumstances I didn't used to have, that is like saying, I've had to wait a long time too, and it's really terrible.
It's a perfect parallel. And while it's a straightforward example, it's not simple theoretically. It's what you've just said is very insightful theoretically, because one of the problems that patients and families have in the experience of healthcare is that they feel that they are being treated like a cog in a wheel, or they're being treated like a car going to the auto body shop, and that the person who's treating them doesn't see them as a human being, but just that thing they were trained to repair. But when you're a human talking about being a father, talking to a mother who's worried about her child, you're a parent and I'm a parent. You're a parent with expertise and I'm a parent who's soliciting your expertise, but together we're parents. And if we're both parents, we're both human beings. And you're not operating on some object. You're relating to me as a person in one of the most central roles of my life and one of the most central roles of yours. I'm saying all of that to show you that this simple reference that you make with your patient's parents actually can be backed by all of that theoretical explanation I just gave. It's simple in its execution, but it's profound in the theory that backs it. If physicians and nurses seemed more human to the patients and families they treat, that would go a long way in establishing a human-to-human connection, a human-to-human relationship.
Autumn, I'm wondering if you could walk us through an example. You have a case that I've seen you use a few times of a teenager with a cervical spine injury who's giving the care team a lot of difficulty. Could you tell us a bit about that patient?
Right. So I often refer to this patient as Fred. Fred is a great example case to use because it's a patient behaving in the worst possible ways, short of physical abuse. I have built this case, Fred, to be an example of a patient who's at the extreme end of the continuum of bad behavior. So Fred is quadriplegic at this moment. Maybe the situation might improve. He's a teenager. He is in a lot of pain. He's at a rehab hospital. There are features of his background that are being discussed among the staff, features like having been arrested for heroin possession or having been truant in school. He's in this condition because of a gunshot wound, and he is yelling when the staff come in. He's disruptive. He's very loud, so it's disrupting other patients. No one wants to work with him, and that's sort of the background of this patient. He's definitely someone that everyone would consider difficult. And what I try to get audiences to do is to think about what would make Fred act this way. What would be the reasons why Fred would be yelling or complaining or using insults? The first thing that people often say is that Fred is angry at his fate. He's angry at his condition. He's angry at the shooter. And he's taking out all of that frustration and anger on the people who are there to care for him and are trying to help him. And I think it's a very common story that I get from physicians. But when I work through this case with others, I'm trying to help people get past that simple explanation to think about why Fred would be angry at them. I don't ever deny that when someone has already been hurt or in pain or frustrated, I don't deny that they have a shorter fuse. What I ask people to do is think about, why would you be angry at the staff if you were in that hospital? Would your anger and frustration and indignation be entirely explained by the condition that you're in, the fact that you're shot and the fact that you're in pain and the fact that you are now paralyzed? Would that explain why you are nasty to this nurse and this physician and this respiratory therapist? And I want people to really think about their own reasons when they are angry. When we think about why other people are angry, we often think it's irrational or it's projection or it's not properly directed. But when we try to focus on our own anger, we never think that our anger at a particular person is really just misdirected anger that was supposed to be at someone else. No, it's always that there's something in the interaction with that particular person that has gone wrong. So in this case, this patient has been described with references to heroin possession and truancy and the gunshot wound. I don't think it takes a lot of moral imagination to imagine that Fred believes that he is not being treated fairly, that he's being stereotyped or that he's being dismissed or that he's being labeled, and that those are a significant source of his anger at the team.
Right. And to go back one step, I don't think it's at all a stretch to imagine that at least some people on the team think that he's a thug, he's uneducated, he's a criminal, and maybe he's got secondary gains, like he wants pain medication or whatever. I mean, there could be a lot of, let's say, ungenerous thoughts about this patient.
And let's use that word ungenerous. If a clinical team has an ungenerous interpretation of a patient or family, they often think that they've masked that ungenerous interpretation. They would say, well, I may think that, but I never showed that to him. That's patently false. Human beings are like bloodhounds for mistreatment. And even if Fred at 16 can't articulate the moral offense that's happening, or the microaggression, or the unequal treatment that he's getting, he feels it. That's how we get the term microaggression. Those are offenses that are hard to name, but they are profoundly experienced, even if the individual can't put their finger quite on it. Anytime a team has an ungenerous, use your word, an ungenerous interpretation of a patient who is behaving in a way that is challenging, the first step for that clinical team is to address their ungenerous interpretation, because they will be found out. In fact, they have been found out. Just like when you were, your child was being born and you were worried that you had landed yourself in the difficult patient category, that's what all people know. Everyone knows that by the reaction that they're getting from the team that they have now been put into that category, in the patient or family's perspective, unjustly, unfairly, because the patient or the family is identifying something that is a wrongdoing. If you do look at me through the lens that I'm a thug, you have violated me. You have demeaned me. And so you're not covering it when you think you are, you're not. If I think that you are seeing me through the lens of interpreting me as a thug, that would be enough to make me difficult. Because being difficult, getting angry at you, is a response to my perception that you've not treated me right.
Because actually what's going on with Fred is he's a kid with a terrible life-changing injury who is alone, who doesn't know what his future is going to bring, who's like devastated basically about what has happened to him.
Who needs your care, not your criticism, not your judgment, not your frustration. He needs your enormous care and concern. And if it's beyond the limitation of what a physician or nurse can offer, then he needs that team to find him the support that can offer him that care and concern. And so instead of thinking about what's Fred's impact on me, the question is, what does Fred need? And who and how do we deliver it?
Right. So that's a great segue. You write about the importance of conflict management skills and tools, and also of ethical reasoning when applied to clinical settings, essentially arguing that in many cases, you know, healthcare providers are not trained formally in these techniques or types of thinking, and that they are necessary to providing patient care, or at least to addressing conflict or difficult situations. Do you think we need more types of people involved with patients, or do we need to better train providers in these methods and ways of thinking?
Both. So we need to give fire extinguishers and conflict management relationship building skills to all nurses and physicians, simple things that can be done quickly that don't trespass on real clinical time. And we need to have point people in units or in hospitals that can be the people that are the firefighters when the fire extinguishers aren't working. And I'm not alone in calling for this. There was a consensus statement of intensivists saying that in units, high stress units like NICUs, there really needs to be someone with a very deep set of conflict management skills. But many people are calling for physicians and nurses to have a very rudimentary set. And if a short podcast is going to deliver something that would be very simple, the technique that I would advocate is to ask the patient what's happening and then to restate what they hear that patient saying in as much accuracy as the physician can muster. when we listen to people, we tend to nod our head. Oh, I'm getting it. I'm getting it. I'm hearing it. We nod our head. We say, oh, okay, yeah, I'm hearing you. The technique that you can learn very quickly is to restate with deep paraphrasing what patients are bringing as their concerns, because it shows rather than tells, I'm listening. And at the very least, we could teach physicians how to do that better.
Better than the stereotypical, that must be very hard for you, that we are sometimes taught.
Right. When I do conflict management workshops, I often say a bunch of gibberish, and then in response to that gibberish, I say, yeah, that's very hard. Yeah, absolutely. Tell me more. Those are the kind of phrases you can say without ever having listened to any content at all. If you want to show me that you care, show me that you're invested, then paraphrase the concerns that I have brought to you. So that is one of the core skills when you're trying to manage someone who's in difficulty, is to use really tight paraphrasing to what they've said.
It's funny because in the days leading up to this conversation with you, I encountered a couple of examples just in the general culture of, I guess, what I see as a sort of reckoning with how the medical establishment can dismiss and gaslight patients and their concerns, their lived experience. Totally coincidentally, with some friends, I watched this movie on Netflix called Take Care of Maya, which is about, in many ways, a mother of a patient who was labeled quite tragically as difficult. And then there's also a new podcast from the New York Times called The Retrievals that's a lot about this. There are books that have come out about chronic disease. The Invisible Kingdom by Megan O'Rourke is an example. I wonder if you perceive a kind of growing awareness or an emergence of this theme in culture more broadly, and if so, what you think it's due to.
What theme? The theme of gaslighting or of dismissal?
Yeah, I think that just these stories of people being treated unjustly in this particular way, essentially of being told that they're crazy or dismissed as making things up or as simply hounding healthcare providers illegitimately, seems to be emerging everywhere.
No, I think that's right. When we think about an ethical concern rising to the level that it receives attention, it's often at the moment when it gets a concept associated with it. When the concept gaslighting was created, it gave patients and families and others, physicians and nurses, a concept to name a phenomenon. So the phenomenon has been happening for, forever. But gaslighting gave individuals a very compact, tightly defined name for that occurrence. And then it becomes the case that different individuals who have had similar experiences can line up that experience and can put it underneath the rubric or that definition of gaslighting. And so, yes, I think we're going to hear a lot now about medical gaslighting, no different from when the term microaggression was created. So I agree. Now that there is this term gaslighting, we are now getting more and more people to say, oh, that is exactly what has happened to me. So I think we're going to hear more and more of it.
To me, that's a good place to end because it highlights the importance and value of what you're bringing to clinical work. So I want to thank you, Autumn, for taking the time to explain some of it to me and to our listeners, and for all your work.
It was my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
That was my conversation with Autumn Feaster. For more information, check out the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show and rate it on the platform of your choice and spread the word. And if you have any comments or guest suggestions, please don't hesitate to reach out through the show's website, practicingpod.com. That's practicing with a C. I'll be back with more conversations on practicing, so stay tuned. Practicing is hosted, written, and produced by me, Sam Freeman. Sarah Freeman provides invaluable editorial advice. Artwork is by Jeff Landman. Music is by Mr. Smith, made available under Creative Commons licensing. Thanks also to Juniper Belshaw, Jeff Dyke, Katarina Haddad, Jess Malls, Howard Mitnick, Ezra Siller, and Catherine Tang.